You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to legendary UK small and mid-cap fund manager Christopher Mills and Nick Mills from Harwood Capital. So welcome, gents.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Yeah, not bad at all. Actually, I'm delighted to be able to speak to you guys again. And we've had lots of news, certainly over the last week. We've got Joe Biden, who's decided to withdraw from the US presidential election. We had the revealing of the Labour government's new growth strategy in Parliament last Wednesday. And of course, the huge IT outage caused by sort of CrowdStrike and Microsoft on Friday, which stopped all the RNSs going through. But before we run through your outlook for the market, I don't suppose you could quickly remind investors of sort of like what stocks you like, what kind of investors are sort of like investments for Harwood Capital?
Yes, basically, we would describe ourselves as value investors with a catalyst. That catalyst can often be us putting people on boards to create value or aligning boards to create value. It's very important if you're a value investor that you don't get into so-called value traps. So we're very focused on management teams and how good they are. We like to invest with management teams on numerous occasions. So an example would be Ian Johnson, who we first invested in when he was on Celsius, then Ciprotex, then Bioquell, and obviously more recently, something Nick's going to be talking about, which is Niox. And in the meantime, he did Clinigen as well. So there's an example of us backing an individual over very long periods of time, which I think works very well because the individual knows what we expect, and we know what he can deliver. And therefore, there's a mutuality of interest before we make the investment, as long as, because we know what we both want out of the agenda. If that makes sense to you.
No, it does, yeah. I mean, there's a principle in stock selection, you run your winners, but you're using it for your management teams, aren't you, there? You've sort of like got, you're sticking to somebody who you know works well. And just turning to Nick, I've got to say a big thanks because I was a investor in Crestchick, and I understand certainly you were on the board there and helped be the catalyst, maybe. And there was an extra one penny as well on that £4 bid, I remember, from coming in from Agrico. But before we sort of like run through some stocks, Nick, I don't suppose you could just take us through sort of like what your background is and your sort of experience in the fund manager industry.
Yeah, sure. The brief history is went out to Boston for university to do undergrad business school, specializing in finance. And from there, I got a job at GAMCO, which is Gabelli Asset Management up in Westchester, for a man called Mario Gabelli, who is very well known in the US amongst their investors, perhaps less so over here. But it's a value style approach. And I was an industrials based analyst, so that's my sort of area of comfort for conglomerates, specifically in the value style, private market value with a catalyst. I left Gabelli in 2018 and joined Harwood January 2019. My primary day-to-day responsibility is the management of Oryx, which I co-manage with Christopher and look to source the new ideas and meet with companies, and I've been sitting on a few boards. So my current boards are Trifast, Hargreaves Services, and NIOPS. And as you say, I sat on Crestcheck. That was a short but sweet board of about a year, and we were able to deliver a very positive return for shareholders and get the business sold to Aggreko. I won't take credit for the 1p though, that's
well, you can take credit for the 4 pounds.
I will, a little bit of credit for the 4 pounds.
Yeah, I guess you probably have some quite interesting debates over the dinner table sometime, or a bottle of red wine. Now, Christopher, just in terms of the returns, how's the portfolio Oryx and sort of like Nasdaq performed so far this year and over the longer term?
Well, if we sort of focus on Oryx for today, because we're really going to be discussing stocks in Oryx.
Yeah.
Since inception, the fund's now up 20 times. During that period, tragically, the AIM market is actually down, and the FTSE small cap excluding investment trust is just up over 2 times. It's pretty similar figures. If you could do 15 years, we're up nearly 9 times. FTSE AIM up 80%. FTSE small cap are still up only 2 and a bit times. 10 years would be, we're up 2 times, a bit more, 2.3 times. FTSE small cap up 30% in the AIM market, sadly down another 13%. The figures keep going like that through 1 year, and year to date, the FTSE AIM's up, well, was up to the end of June, just on, well, up, was flat actually. FTSE small cap, excluding investment trust, up 6, and we're up 9 and a bit. So something's definitely working.
Yeah, just going to say, I mean, looking just logically, it's certainly in terms of the, you know, your active view, you know, your sort of active bias when it comes to sort of investing when it in small caps. How do you see that outlook going forward and the sort of strategy for investors to adopt? Is it basically you've got to be very stock selective and active rather than, if you could even find a tracker, I don't know.
Well, you wouldn't want to, would you, with that?
No, exactly.
I think that's a very good idea. Yes, it is all to do with stock selection. I think it is also to do with having an investment process. And also, if you actually look at our investments, we're not particularly short-term investors. Mm-hmm. You know, we have holdings we've had for relatively long periods of time. And when we look at a company, and we're going to give you some examples of that today, we're looking at, you know, often how we see that company developing over the next 3 years rather than over the next 3 minutes. Because in our view, trading stocks is a mugs game and you never make any money.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Okay, if anybody wants to ask Chris or Nick any questions, please put them into the chat button. I'll read them out. We've already had plenty over the last few days and overnight. Let's start with one I had last couple of days, just on NIOCS, Nick. I don't suppose you could just quickly give us an update on there. That's really sort of like being a poster-child investment, because I spoke to Christopher about 4 years ago when it was languishing at about 24, 25p. And he banged the table and he convinced my dad, but not me. And I should have backed him, but it's now at about 65. So what's the sort of the forward road path for the business?
Sure. And obviously they, Paul, as you'll know, they had an update recently, just last week. So the listeners will have seen that. So NIOCS market cap of about 282 million as it stands, with 21.5 million net cash. So around 260 enterprise value. As you know, from before, this business has been restructured. It was formerly Sakasa PLC with a lot of net debt. It was a Woodford mess with a cat allergy drug. Ian Johnson, who is the exec chairman, has come in, relicensed that drug back to AstraZeneca, cleaned up the balance sheet, and you now have a highly profitable business generating about £1 million a month in cash plus. The company itself, for those who don't know, is Pheno Testing. It's the number one in the world. It's the most accurate in the world. That is ring-fenced by the sensor that is contained in the device, which is the sensor we have exclusive rights over.
So it's asthma diagnostics, isn't it?
Asthma diagnostics, exactly. So it's testing the nitrogen in the lungs. And the business itself, the other benefit we have as a profitable company is the tax loss carry forwards, also courtesy of Mr. Woodford, which are circa north of 600 million. So you're not going to be paying tax anytime soon on this. The important bit to understand is with this cash generation, we're not necessarily looking to diversify or do bolt-on M&A. So as this cash builds, the likely outcome is it being returned to shelves, and whether it be a dividend or a share repurchase. As you saw last year, we did a dividend, and as that cash continues to build, we would look for another way to return it to shareholders. In terms of the strategy, it's grown extremely well. The margins have improved year on year. Ultimately, we need to expand our presence in the US. So as you see earnings come out in the presentation decks, you want to look to that number. How can we get to 15% plus growth in the US and really scale this business? That would be my opening response to that.
Yeah. So it's basically it's an attractive runway ahead in terms of US expansion, new products, and you know, basically just growing organically. And maybe they've got a big cash balance actually that they could do some M&A as well.
The M&A is unlikely just because it's going to increase our risk. At the moment, you know, the asthma market itself is relatively small and misunderstood. So ultimately, we're trying to increase the awareness. And actually, when competitors come online, they're typically a lower quality product, but what they do help us with is their marketing spend, because as they spend money increasing awareness of this space, we are the most benefited because we are the best in class and highest quality products. So as you know, there's a lot of room to grow organically here, and there are levers we can pull. There's a next generation product we can implement. Management have mentioned at-home testing. I think we're still a bit far away from that, but it is something that can come into effect later on that we can spend money on developing.
Okay, good. Positive outlook. That positive out there for NIOX. Now, Christopher, I remember at the Mellow conference down in Chizzy, I think it was before Christmas, you talked about Pinewood Technologies. And again, this was one before it's sort of gone through its metamorphosis into the software as a service sort of car dealership software platform. And you sort of again pointed it out to investors. It's been a terrific winner since. What's your latest on this one? Steve Walters is just asking about Pinewood as well.
Okay, well, it's very difficult, I suppose, to say that we still love a stock that's gone up over 100% in 5 months. but the reality is we still do. In fact, we're still buying it at these levels. I think we just need to remember the story. The company has formally said that by 2027, market cap today is about 300 million. There's no debt, a few 10 million plus in cash. They publicly stated that the expected EBITDA for 2027 in the United Kingdom business is in fact 27 million pounds, so it's easy to remember. That's all SaaS-based revenue, and one of the advantages they've had is that since they're no longer part of Pendragon, a number of their Pendragon's competitors are now starting to use them, but it just takes time to install these systems. You've got to get out of the old contracts. We then, of course, have the Lynthia joint venture, and that is a 51% owned by Lynthia and 49% owned by Pendragon in the United States. Lynthia is currently spending way over $100 million on this. Our original indications from management, they would hope to get something like $60 million of revenue and $30 million of EBITDA, which would result in another $12 million of EBITDA for the company. So you're looking at a business in 2027 that should be doing, or at least finishing the year at a run rate of 14 million EBITDA, all SaaS revenue. By then the cash balances will have built, and you know, there's no reason to believe this thing can't trade at 15 times, which would take you to 600 million. Yeah. And even if it's 13 and a half times, it'd be covered by the cash. So what's not to like?
That's double. I mean, it's about just less than 300 million market caps. So if you can get to 600 million, that's a good double. I did notice actually at the weekend, Tetian, who were basically a competitor out in the US, just did a 4 billion dollar fundraise for their SaaS car dealership, and their revenues are less than $200 million. So that's a 20 times sales multiple. They've just raised cash.
Well, the other side too, of course, is their competitor in the United Kingdom basically went down.
Oh, okay.
Which has not helped, which has opened up more opportunity for them. And also, I think it's worth pointing out that Lynthia is actually still buying stock in Pinewood, and they know what the numbers are.
Yeah.
So they've been adding to their existing holding.
Okay.
So, you know, when I first talked about this stock, I always said I thought it was a 4 to 5 timer. We've done the first double. I'm pretty confident over the next 3 years we'll do the next one.
No, it sounds good. Okay, let's switch back to life science. We've got another popular one, Christopher. I know you probably can't say too much about it. It's EKF Diagnostics. I think you're on the board, aren't you? And they've probably got a trading update coming out. So maybe just one or two words, just how you see that. Because
we do have a trading update coming out this week. So I'll have to refer back to what we said at the time of our annual general meeting, where basically we said, look, we've got nice cash balances. We've got no debt. The core point of care business is growing nicely, throwing off lots of cash. And the key now is developing the enzymes business. And that is taking longer than we thought. But one of the things that's being considered now is actually we have a whole number of enzymes of our own, which we could use for the diagnostics part of our business. So that's an area that's now being looked into. We do have a state-of-the-art enzyme facility. There's probably only 5 or 6 in the world as good as ours. If somebody wanted to build another one, it would probably take 3 to 4 years. So in the long term, we're very excited about it. It will add significantly to the profitability of the business. But it's just taking a bit longer than we thought, and that's kind of in the public domain too.
Yeah.
And there'll be an update that's certainly within the next 7 days.
Yeah. No, I love that. The blood sort of diagnostic sort of testing for iron and hemoglobin and lactose and glucose. That's just a sort of like a massive cash cow with recurring revenue streams. And then you've got the upside.
And the demand is very strong for that. I mean,
yeah.
It's one of the sadnesses that all these wars around the world actually require a lot of testing for hemoglobin.
Mm.
So that's been a sort of tailwind for us. Not a happy one, but nevertheless, it is one.
Mm. Another tailwind is actually my wife keeps basically giving blood and plasma every 2 weeks. And she gets tested by one of these little handheld devices, which I'm pretty sure that comes from EKF. Now, Nick, just to switch sectors, let's go to the industrial fasteners sector, Trifast, that is going through a bit of a turnaround itself, a lot of self-help in terms of reducing cost. It's obviously still very cheap. Trades at roughly around about 11, 12 times earnings on trough sort of like profitabilities. What sort of attracted you to this one? Because I'm guessing it's a classic sort of like roll your sleeves up and get the business singing again.
Yes. Well, just for your listeners, Trifast market cap at 100 million, 21 and a half million of net debt for 120 million enterprise value, with EBITDA of about 18 and a half on 230 million of sales. This business has been around for a pretty long time. I think it's about 1976. And throughout its history, it has typically had margins in the low double digit range, 10 to 13%. It has been fixed, broken. So we believe we're buying at a time that it's broken, and we want to be part of the journey fixing it and then keep it there. So if you speak to Ian Percival, who's the CEO, who's the new CEO, he came in last year. He's come from Accenture, where he led the packaging restructuring there and did an extremely good job. He will tell you recovery, rebuild, and resilience. The margins at the moment are 5%. So there's the opportunity. Why is a business that sits in all these attractive industries, has 18 sites around the world, it's manufacturing and distribution, it has very strong relationships with its customers, very good track record of delivery. So there's no reason this business should not be doing 10%. Mm-hmm. there's a new board, new chairwoman, new CEO, and a new CFO coming in. So this is and that wasn't my fault, by the way. So this is basically a new board, new management team, which is a new experience for me, but very focused on margin growth. And one of the problems this business has had is with its customer complexity. And what that means is there were too many customers, and if you were Jim down the road asking for 100 fasteners, that was honored. And if you're asking for 1 million fasteners, that was honored. So you had these tiny customers and these large customers, as well as large contracts that were loss making. So one of Ian's jobs is to go to these large customers, either reprice them and make some money off them, or, you know, it's a tough conversation. But ultimately, you're going to see revenue. This is no longer a top line growth story. You'd rather have the margin appreciation. So if revenue's flat and margins up, that's kind of what we're going for. And the margin levers he's going for are just focused growth. That's the complexity issue I mentioned. Operational efficiencies. We've consolidated the UK operations into the National Distribution Centre. It's been a bit of a painful process. It's been going on for the last few years. And it's taken a bit longer, as these things do. And that's driving about 3 million of savings a year. Strong management, as I said, there's 18 sites, making sure we've got the right people across the world that are running these sites, that there's a sort of direct message to them. I think Ian's been really good about that. The poor man's been on a plane, I think, so twice a week since he joined, and just having strong heads, strong leadership. So something I'm going to talk about later is CBAM, and we'll discuss that at Hargreaves Services. But that, I'd just like to reference it now because it's not going to be a negative impact for Trifast. We use primarily green steel from Europe. It's about 95% sourced. But I'll explain CBAM a bit later. This is probably a 3 to 4 year story, to be honest with you, Paul. You know, there's a lot to do. The positives are that it's very low hanging fruit. And as you say, the stock looks cheaper where it is. We would certainly hope to double the share price, at least up to about 140p. Over the next 3 years, we'll be working very hard to get the business there.
And that, I think, is what the management incentive is too, isn't it?
The management incentive will be around there, yes.
And just in terms of sort of turnarounds, obviously it requires certain skills and it typically carry greater risk. There's obviously a lot of self-help rather than actually external factors that need to be influenced. But how long would you give sort of seeing the first green shoots, Nick, coming through? You know, that from that plan, because what sort of triggers you to tell you whether the turnaround is on track or not?
I think one of the elements that has been difficult is just visibility on the forward order book and the ERP system that went in. So as Ian gets the high quality leadership across the world, I think that will be helpful as we get a bit more order visibility, which we're working on very hard at the moment. But in terms of the margin, I mean, later half of this year, we've got some earnings coming out very soon. So you should see, I'm not going to say what's involved in the earnings, but you just want to keep an eye on that margin. And really, as we get into next year, there should be a steepening uplift on that margin. And as I said, by the third year, going to the fourth year, we'd expect to be at 10 or 11%. So you can slightly straight line that. The heavy lifting is being done now, and then you'll reap those benefits from next year onwards.
Good. Okay, we'll look forward to that one. Okay, let's switch sectors. We've got Christopher. We've got cars, which I think is a sort of like a bit of a combination of an agri tech business. It does sort of animal feed, but also has got a really quite a niche robotics business that helps sort of oil and gas and nuclear. And there seems to be a bit of Harwood magic going on here in terms of some of the parts and unbundling. Can you take us through your latest on this one?
Yes. Okay. So as you said, Cars Group, I think in the past it was a bit of a sleepy business, to be truthful. That's changed quite a lot. Mm-hmm. There's two businesses in there. One, and this is in the public domain, is a nuclear business, which is being sold. There was a recent broker's circular which estimated that a fair price for that could be £80 million. And we need to put this in the context of Cars Group. There's about 94 million shares outstanding. The company has no debt, about $8 million in cash, and it has various freehold properties that doesn't really relate to a business that it sold, which are worth somewhere around $5 to $6 million. So if you put those assets together, you're looking at £1 a share, which means you're getting the agricultural business for around about £40 million. The agricultural business is a market leader in, well, it's not very sophisticated, it's salt licks. But salt licks, but salt licks are actually used in animal fertility. The company is now addressing a number of problems which it had and which it let slip for years, including, you know, one facility that was significantly loss-making, where they're now bringing in automating equipment, which will turn it around into at least a break-even and hopefully profitability. There's a separate problem they've got at the moment, which is that there's a drought in the United States, which means that demand isn't as strong in the United States as it should be. But this is a really nice business. It's got good market shares in Europe, particularly United Kingdom, a reasonable market share in America, and obviously operates in countries like Australia, although New Zealand isn't quite as profitable as it should be. I think New Zealand's kind of a break-even event. When we did the analysis on this company, our average purchase price is about 110p. We believe that the ultimate breakup value of the business, or ultimate private market value of the business, is at least 200 pence per share. I don't think I've seen anything to change my mind on that. What is absolutely for certain now, you know, this company is now being run for the benefit of its shareholders. So I think, and we expect further significant capital appreciation over the next couple of years. It would be unrealistic to assume that the agricultural business needs probably 2 years of TLC before you can maximize the value of it.
For that agricultural business, ultimately, if they spin off or sell the robotics business, then the agricultural business presumably would fit more logically in a larger agricultural business, in sort of like a Cargill or something like that, wouldn't they?
Logically, yes, it would. I'm not saying there's any intention of selling at the moment, because there isn't. Basically, as I said, it's work in progress. And we don't want to give the value that can be created over the next couple of years to somebody else.
Makes sense. Okay, Nick, now let's turn to Hargreaves Services. You mentioned it earlier on. Again, a similar sort of unbundling play. Amalgamation of three divisions. It's got a land development side. It's got a recycling business out in Germany, joint venture, I think, and also is a civils contractor, presumably going to benefit from the Labour Party's sort of infrastructure spend. So how have you seen the sort of value in unlocking that that sort of value going forward?
Sure. So again, for your listeners, about 183 million market cap, about 23 million in net cash, a very strong balance sheet. I think what we've done really well in the last year and a half or so is just explaining the complexity of the business. Paul, you mentioned that there's the land, the German JV, and the industrial services. There's also within those four or five other businesses, Legomas, your earthworks, logistics, minerals, and aggregates business. In the last year, we've been very successful at just tidying that up and explaining to shareholders that this is an asset realization play. And you can see that with the dividend that was announced. So that's about 36p a share, up from, what was it for? Sort of 9, I think. So it's a substantial increase, and that's well supported for the next few years. In addition to that, you arguably get special dividends as we realize these assets. So, Paul, you mentioned in the land portfolio, we have these renewable assets, which are essentially ground rent for wind farm developers, battery storage. Those will, and I just again need to be a bit careful because our earnings are in sort of 2 weeks.
Yeah, okay.
But you will see how those assets are now phased into the sales process and that cash flow coming in over the next 3-4 years. Those were independently valued by JLL. I think the first tranche is sort of 10, 12 million, and then it scales up from there. Germany is an important element to talk about because in the last 3 years, we've had these super profits, COVID, the Russian-Ukraine war, obviously driving pig iron prices through the roof. And the last year, you've seen that settle down now and zinc prices have come down. I believe management mentioned in the last update that they're seeing strong recovery there. And the conversations we've had recently around this CBAM, I don't know if you know what CBAM is, Paul. It's, a lot of people
don't. I thought it was a radio. It was one of those CBCs.
No, CBAM is interesting. It's the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. And it's coming into effect in Europe in January 2026. And it's something that I think people need to start looking at and paying attention to. And what it essentially means is any material that uses a lot of, it's very carbon intensive and is imported into Europe will be subject to a carbon tax. Now that can range, that is still being matriculated, but it can be anywhere between half a credit to 2 credits per ton of imported goods. So think cement, steel, iron, fertilizer, hydrogen, these are all subject to that tax. So what does that mean for us? Well, we produce our own pig iron. It's taken from steel dust and coke and coal. So essentially, we can knock that price through into our products. And if we're conservative here and we say half a credit of price on what we produce 250,000 tons. The current carbon credit price is 66 euros, so 33 times a quarter of a million, that's 8.25 million pounds of additional profit, or euros, I should say, of additional profit, which can scale. The other benefit that we get is the Russian embargo. There is going to be one eventually coming into place by 2026. The Russians currently export 1.6 million tons of pig iron. That is being gradually brought offline. I believe our lawyer, Hargreaves, wrote a stern letter to the European Commission because the Russians were dumping pig iron into Turkey, who were then selling it to the European countries. That is now being looked at and stopped. And then land, you know, land is land. It takes a while. We've got big biomass sites. As you know, the housing market has been down in the dumps. Hopefully with Labour, you know, they've made a lot of noise. So we'll see if they deliver.
So there's a lot of moving parts. A lot of moving parts there, Nick. The shares currently trade at roughly around about £5.60. What's the sort of, if you asset realised all of those relevant parts, what would you sort of like hope as a shareholder to
be careful?
Okay, you'll be careful, right? Okay.
I would say on a bad day, £8 a share.
Yeah.
On a bad day. And that would be valuing Germany at about £2 a share, which would not have any benefit of CBAM that I've just mentioned, and would have a pretty baseline recovery of the German assets. So on a bad day, I put Germany at £2. I put land and industrials at about £6, maybe a bit more, depending on how the renewable shapes out. I'm comfortable saying that number.
And you've got 50-60p a share in cash.
And we've obviously got the 25 million of cash.
Yeah.
So I think there is, the stated NAV. The stated NAV is well above where we are, but on an asset realization basis. And I think it's important for your listeners to understand. With AIM, we talk about what's tomorrow.
Sorry. It's just.
They obviously think Hargreaves Services is a good investment as well. Sorry about this, listeners. We're nearly there. We're back now.
Sorry, that goes off if I say something inappropriate.
Okay. No, that £8 plus certainly chimes with with some of the brokers I've seen, and also some of the other fund managers I've spoken to. So
What I was saying, Paul, is I think the great thing with this business is you're talking about an asset value that sits there today. That is £8 of value that we've got today. So we're unlocking that. We're not going, we hope we're here in 2 or 3 years and that's what it might be worth. That's where we sit. So there's growth, there's additional gains on that. And it's just a case of being very careful and firm about how we realize these assets and then return that capital to shareholders.
Yeah. Okay, we've got one question coming in from George Roach, Christopher. He asks, what's the sort of the one main factor that has been a key to your sort of incredible investment success? I'm guessing you talked about sort of unbundling and catalysts and stuff, but is there anything else that sort of like is pretty unique to you guys?
I suppose there's two aspects to it. One, basically not trying to chase the latest thing. We have a process and sticking to the process. Now, there'll be times when that process is out of fashion. 2000 would be a good example of that. But if you try and follow the latest thing, you're pretty well doomed. The second aspect, which doesn't really focus so much in these presentations, is that historically we've been very successful in making private investments, and that's been a big drive to North Atlantic's performance over the years. So I think sticking to process, not deviating, has worked very well for us. I said this long-term approach where we're not trying to trade, we're trying to understand a business and see how we can make a lot of money over a period of time. It is the basis of the success.
Yeah. Paul, just on top of that, we mentioned the board seats. I looked through the Oryx portfolio the other day, there's about 40, 42 investments. And within that, we have either direct being ourselves or indirect board representation on 23. So, north of 50% of the holdings. I think that's very unique for any other fund in the UK to have that kind of presence on the underlying holdings.
Yeah, certainly rolling up your sleeves when the things get that then get tough. And I did notice actually,
there are others who are helping us.
Well, I did know also what your father, you've got a good lineage there, Christopher, because your father, Christopher Bertram Mills, I understand, was one of the best UK sort of like spy managers. He worked for MI5 and MI6, so you're very curious and you can do a lot of investigation, I imagine.
Well, we can give a plug for the book, if that's all right. Yes, my father was indeed a spy. He did work for MI5 and MI6. At the same time, he also ran, which was the largest circus in the United Kingdom, Bertram Mills Circus, which was used before the war as a cover for his spying activities in Germany. And the book is called The Spy Who Came In From the Circus, written by Christopher Andrews, who wrote the official history of MI5. So there you go. Yeah.
Good. I must admit, and I've only had a chance to read the first chapter, but certainly one thing which comes through from your father is extremely determined and, competitive. And that's one of the things that you need as an investor. You need resilience. You need determination when things go wrong. So just a mental trait. Okay, we've got a question came in from the previous few days. Tim Hughes, he was just asking about a quick word, Christopher, on Renalytics and Verici. Renalytics does sort of like AI-based blood testing for kidney disease out in the States. And it's just got FDA approval, I think. And then Verici does diagnostics for kidney transplant patients out in the States. And it just secured a real flagship agreement with Thermo Fisher.
So
just a quick couple of words on both of those. Okay, so
Verici, as you said, has done this agreement with Thermo Fisher. The next milestone for Verici will be national coverage determination, which means that Medicare and Medicaid can pick up the bills all over the place. It is properly funded. Renalytics, I almost can't believe it. It has achieved so many milestones, and yet the share price is pathetic. It needs funding from time to time, which has been one of the issues. What is happening now is that they've now got a direct sales force, and that is resulting in doctors now starting to use the product, and there's some real momentum there. But certainly recently it's been very disappointing, to be honest.
Yeah. And I guess both of those businesses are going to benefit from AI, aren't they? Because, they're exponents of it, and it's mining huge data to improve that whole diagnostic journey.
That's not true. But Verici isn't an AI business, but Renalytics most certainly is. Verici's products basically enable you to determine how to treat yourself after you've had the kidney transplant and also determine how much... how they control the impact of the drugs they put in you to reduce your immune system. And if you get that wrong, there's a very high probability of getting cancer. So, but it's not AI driven.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking more. They've got a biobank, haven't they, of sort of like urine samples and human parts.
Yeah, they have that as well. And there is value in that biobank. You're right.
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, let's move to animal care. We've got basically they do sort of animal health, sort of pharmaceuticals, and they just sold. I mean, this is incredible. And I don't think any of you appreciate it. They had a sort of non-core asset, which they sold for about £25 million a few months back. And that gives them a sort of like a really rock solid balance sheet to invest in new products and into perhaps some M&A to buy in some more pharma. What's your sort of your latest on this one, Christopher? Because I know you've talked about it before. And I feel like a bit of a rock star CEO, Jenny Winter.
Yes, she definitely is. Right. In fact, she also then went and sold another non-core asset.
Oh, did she?
Twice what it was in the books for. So her cash is now about £31 million. So if you look at animal care, which we think is just a must-own stock at this level, you've got 140 million market cap. You've got no debt. You've got 30, so call it, keep it around 30 million in cash. The core business, if you exclude public company expenses, probably is doing somewhere between 12.5 and 13 million of EBITDA. 60% of what she sells is either her drug or proprietary drugs, which no one else has. So this has nothing to do with CVS, right? Mm. They supply a CVS. And without proprietary drugs, these businesses trade for about 12 times. With them, we'd think this is probably worth 13 times. So, no, sorry, 14 to 15 times EBITDA, which means that the thing is trading at a monumental discount to its private market value. But that's not actually the reason why you want to own this thing. She is in the process of developing two biologics. And these are drugs for pain management for horses and companion animals. At the moment, the probability of these things working is probably about 30%, but there will be more trials done over the next 2 years. She'll know horses by probably the end of this year, companion animals by the end of next year, as to whether there's a chance of these things working. If they do work, sales will start in 2029, but we're looking at peak sales of probably somewhere in the region of 120 to 140 million with a profit margin on them of 50%. So you've got this little company. If it works, this thing could go up five times. If it doesn't work, it's still cheap. And the other thing to remember is that everyone got very excited about this company when we had COVID. And the stock went up a lot. It then drifted back. But the truth is that young animals don't get sick. They start to get sick basically from about 5 years onwards. So that COVID boom in pets is now going to be a huge tailwind for her as she goes out for the next 3-4 years as well. So you've got a really good balance sheet, a really good chief executive, tailwinds, and the possibility of a huge victory if these two drugs work.
And they're
addressing a very big market.
I think the poster child
is AstraZeneca, where she did drugs. Yeah. So she knows what she's doing.
I think the poster child of the sector is Zoetis out in the States. And they trade, last time I saw, over 20 times EBITDA. In fact, I think it was closer to 30 times. But they're certainly at a significant premium to 12 times EBITDA. Got another question.
No. Strip out the cash. You're 110 million. You're down to 8.5. It's completely the wrong price.
Okay. Another one from Steve. He's just asking about a quick update on Spire Healthcare. That's the private health business in the UK. And I guess the shares have done very well, asset backed, presumably going to benefit from all the elective procedures. I guess the one question is there any risk from the new Labour government in terms of, I don't know, putting VAT onto medical bills or insourcing some of the work they do?
Well, actually, the government's saying they're going to outsource to Spire.
Oh, are they?
And I can't see them putting VAT on medicine somehow. I think that would be kind of counterproductive.
Yeah.
But Spire is actually one of our favorite stocks. The forecast for this year's EBITDA is about 270 million. Market cap's around about a billion. The debt's about 1.1 billion. So it's trading about 8x. It's got 1.2 billion of freehold property. But much more importantly, if you look into 2027, by then that they've announced, there's a huge self-help program that they're doing. And they believe that will increase their profitability by 60 million. And then if you basically say the rest of it kind of grows at sort of 5% per annum, which would seem conservative, you're looking at about 370 million in brokers' forecasts for 2027. That will enable them over the period to pay down about 200 million of the debt. Now the debt is a mixture of real debt and then IFRS 16 debt. So the real debt will be down to, 100, 150 million pounds by then. But that means that the EV/EBITDA multiple have fallen to 5. Now, if the multiple just merely remains the same at 8, you know, you're looking at a stock that could double again over the period. There's also the possibility that Ramsey, that owns 30% of the company, which Ramsey itself was taken over by the Rembrandts of South Africa, might look for a bidder one day. So you've got something that really stacks up on fundamentals and really stacks up on the possibility that there could be a bid. And if you look at, if you split it out into an opco propco, again, you can get a share price doubling over the period because of the 1.2 billion in freehold property sitting in there.
Yeah,
I think that would value the opco at 6.5 times EBITDA.
Yeah, I think one of the big sort of private equity infrastructure funds would love this, wouldn't they? They just
or another hospital group.
Yeah.
I kind of feel it's a sitting duck, but the whole point of it is it's backed up by fundamentals. You haven't got huge bid premiums in there. We've met the management several times. What they're saying makes a huge amount of sense. Yeah. Ironically, they're kind of trying to do what we did at Ten Entertainment, which is look at the fact that we have a box and how do we maximize the profitability per square foot. They're now moving cosmetic surgery out of their operations rooms and focusing on much higher margin things like hips and knees, which sadly for all of us is a growth industry.
Yeah, no, I know. I've got a couple of friends.
Emerging in growth industry.
Yeah, no, I've got one friend who's getting a hip, another one's getting a knee, so in the next few months. Okay, we've got another question from Nicholas Slater. He's basically asking about what's the best way to sort of learn about the stock market? Is it sort of get your hands dirty, do a bit of, you know, do investing, et cetera, go and work for somebody like, you know, some Super Mario out in the States, Mario Gabelli, or alternatively, any books at all that you'd recommend, or how best to sort of like, you know, to get a better feel? I guess you don't want to try too hard and try and knock the ball out of the park when you first start.
Well, I suppose Nick did 5 years at Super Mario before he came here. I was very lucky. I spent my early years at Sammy Montague, where they trained us very well indeed. We were all given areas where we had to become industry specialists on. So one of mine was the railroad industry at the time in America. And we were basically taught to be analysts, I suppose, buy-side analysts. And I think actual experience working for people who know what they're doing is probably the best way to learn. But I appreciate that's harder for a lot of, you know, private client investors.
Yeah.
And they just simply don't have the access to the data and the people that, you know, people like us are lucky to have.
I think also just be very active with, you know, the FT Business Book of the Year. You can look at the shortlist. I always look at those to see what books, you know, might be interesting. And it's stuff like Chip War by Chris Miller, which helps you understand the global supply chain. It made Nvidia a screaming buy. I didn't buy the stock. I think it was about $100 a share at the time, but we'll move on quickly. And the one I read recently is Material World, written by Sky News. Ed Conway wrote Material World. Chris Miller wrote Chip War, which is all about the raw materials that change the world, you know, copper, lithium, iron, oil, sand, all that salt. which sounds boring, but it's fascinating, I promise. And then if you're sort of very casual about it, there's these great books like The Little Book That Beats the Market. They're all written by the likes of Joel Greenblatt or a specialist investor. They're very small, they're pocket-sized, and they give you a bit of colour, and they're quite fun to read. So I'm always, you know, Richard Stavely and I pass each other a book every couple of weeks to grow. Well, so we've got quite a good dynamic with that, actually. And just, you know, read the Investor's Chronicle. Just make sure you're keeping your broad information base up to speed.
Yeah, and I would add, you know, what's also good is, you know, I'm very grateful to you guys investors being able to listen to, you know, sort of like well-respected fund managers who have beaten the markets over a long term. You two and Richard and plenty of others, and you learn a lot from there. And I think underlying, if you've got a passion, or I would class it as an addiction to stocks, you just love it. You just carry on doing it, and you'll find a way. And it comes through from you guys that you've been doing it and loving it for decades. So that's a sort of the key thing. If you love it, you'll get good at it.
Yeah.
But I mean, going back to the question, though, you know, it's a huge advantage to be able to have, you know, the management of Spire or the management of Pinewood Inn, to have a chance to chat with them for an hour. Sometimes visit these companies. So we probably visit, 15, 20 companies a year between all of us, perhaps even more in fact. And, you know, that helps you understand the business better, because when you visit the company, like the last one I visited, you know, it wasn't just the chief executive and the CFO we were talking to. We ended up talking to the head of every division, so that they tell us their vision for what they're doing and how they're going to improve their margins, how they're going to grow their business, what their targets are, and how they're going to achieve those targets. So that's a big competitive advantage for somebody like us. But of course, as you said, you've got to have the enthusiasm behind it, and not just sit in your office and wait for these people to come and visit you.
Yeah. That must have been a terrifying prospect for those divisional MDs to speak to you, Christopher.
No, it's in a good mood.
Okay, we've got another question coming from David Redwood. He's asking about Avingtraz, Christopher. What's your latest on this? Was an engineering business that has got a couple of rock star CEO and CFO, the two Steves, and they're big into sort of like engineering into HS2 and the nuclear. They do sort of like, you know, bespoke sort of pumps and motors and stuff like this, and they also do high security boxes for Sellafield in that whole nuclear. And then the other side, they've got this growth platform, but a high real growth platform in their new medical devices business with their MRI and X-ray scans. What's just sort of your latest on this one? Because I think they just raised their expectations for the year closing, I think largely because they hadn't quite spent as much on the healthcare side.
Well, that's true. I mean, we're just puzzled, frankly, the stocks can't come back, because it makes absolutely no sense. All the operating businesses we understand are doing really well at the moment. If you exclude the medical side, you've got two sides here. You've got these operating businesses where they have a sort of Melrose approach, where they buy a business, they improve it, and then they exit it. All the exits they've done so far have been very good. I think you'll see them probably do more exits over the next couple of years. I think the bigger challenge might be to find new businesses to buy. Our view, we've said it more than once on with you, is that the industrial business is worth at least £5 a share. There's a property in Luton which also has some value, which could be realized one day. And then you've got the medical businesses, which we don't understand as well, but if we listen to them, they believe they could also be worth £5 a share. So share price of 375 makes absolutely no sense when the industrial businesses are worth, I said, north of £5.
Yeah.
And this is a management team who are very motivated. They perform very well. They don't, so far, touch wood, they've not made any mistakes. They bought a nuclear door business for nothing. And, you know, that business, I think, is now apparently making £2 or 3 million. So what's not to like? It's just the wrong price.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I think that healthcare business, the medical devices, if that's sort of like when it gets sort of traction a bit, a couple of years down the road, I mean, that's just like perfect to spin off or to, you know, to realize value from it. I'm with you. We've got another
exciting product, because it basically the first time you'll be able to do, you know, it's sufficiently cheap. You'll be able to do MRI scans on animals and make them affordable. It's very light, so you don't have to, if you put a big MRI scanner, you have to strengthen the floor. Yeah. You don't have to with this product. So if it works, it's a moonshot. If it doesn't, frankly, it'd be sad, but the industrial businesses are worth 50% more than the share price.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Okay, good. We've got another comment from Nicholas Slade, who says, these guys are incredible. May as well give you your money and sleep at night. Now, Christopher, do you have an IHT fund? Now, I understand that you may be doing a sort of like a capital market style day for Oryx for people to have a good look at sort of like potentially investing in your funds. I don't know if you want to talk about how investors can put their money into Harwood.
Well, at the moment, yet we do have IHT funds by definition have to be personalized to the individual. So we do that.
Yeah.
And again, we're not going to be investing in the sort of companies that an Octopus invests in, because we're much smaller, we're much more nimble. Mm. And, you know, the sort of companies that we are investing in are the sort of companies we're talking about today. So Avintrans would be one. Restore, which is another company we like a lot at the moment, is one. I don't know whether you know the Restore story.
Yeah, that's the Restore story. Yeah, that's it's basically an archive business, isn't it? That does documents and it puts them into deep storage for lots of groups. But has also got a technical recycling business or you know for IT and stuff.
Yeah, it's a document storage business. You need to focus on.
Yeah.
The story of Restore is it was run by a gentleman called Charles Skinner. He did an outstandingly good job. The stock was a high-flying stock. He then retired. The head office went from 7 to 57 people, and a number of acquisitions probably could have been better. That CEO has now left. Charles has come back. We've spent a lot of time with him now. And the story is relatively simple. He wants to keep the debt at 1.5 times EBITDA, which he'll achieve by the end of this year. The company's highly cash generative, so it's paying down this debt very fast. If you just take conservative numbers for the growth in EBITDA going up sort of 10% per annum for the next 2 years, you get to about 70 million. By then, the debt's down to 55 million. So you can see there's an opportunity very simply for a massive return of capital, either through share buybacks and or higher dividends, as you go out 2 years. So we think the biggest risk in this thing is he gets bored and retires again. But as long as he stays, we think this thing could easily double from here. Yeah. And certainly when you talked about him about the earnings per share estimates, he is very much more optimistic than any broker's forecasts I've seen. But there again, of course, if he's buying all those shares back, it's very easy to get the earnings per share up.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's talking about getting to 28p of earnings per share by 2027. Mm. And it's about 20p at the moment. Brokers estimate that the value of the storage business alone is, you know, somewhere in the region of £3.50, £3.80 a share. Mm. Against share price today, about £2.65. So that's something we're still buying at the moment. But to go back to the thing, yes, we can't be swamped because our offices aren't that big. But on the September the 11th, we are having a meeting starting, I think, at 10 o'clock to go through Oryx, which Nicholas and I will do in as much detail as investors would like. There will also be a webcam thing on it. And if you go onto the Oryx, I don't know, it's RNS or something, you need to apply through winter floods if you want to attend in person, and they'll tell you also how to come onto the webcam. And this is something we need to do much more often now. So the plan is to do Oryx this time, and that was set off by the fact that Oryx has its AGM in Guernsey, which isn't any use to anybody. But then the idea is we'll do Oryx one quarter, North Atlantic the next, and each quarter we'll do one or the other to give the shareholders a chance to actually discuss directly with us what we own, what we're buying, what we see. So we give greater transparency into these funds, because someone like you knows the market really, really well, but a lot of private clients would say, Christ, I haven't heard of any of these companies. That's a bit scary.
Yeah.
And what we've got to try and persuade people is it's not scary.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I hope you've got a big, big conference room there, Krista, because if you haven't, you'll have to sort of like.
We can probably take about 25 to 30 actually in the room. But then, as I said, there'll be the opportunity to do it on the webcam as well. Yeah.
Well, you might need to think about hiring out Wembley at some point. You never know.
Well, it's not more about it yet. on a 24% discount to NAV, of course.
Yeah. Taylor Swift, eat your heart out. Okay, yeah. another turnaround, Krista. We've got education software business, SaaS software business, Tribal, that has just come through a major sort of like a turning point, actually. It has completed completed the discussions, or it sort of had a difficulty with a big contract out.
I think we weren't describing it.
Yeah, well, that's all finished now. It's done and dusted, so the business can move forward. What's sort of your view on this one? Because it's had a lot of sort of like, you know, banana skins over its time, but now this seems to be the moment that it can really move ahead.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a number of issues. As you said, the Singapore lawsuit was a major distraction, and it ultimately got sorted for considerably less than the worst case fears. But there are a number of tailwinds now, which should see the share price start to improve, because this is actually fundamentally a good business. The first one is they've had a huge amount of development expenditure on admission system software. And that is now coming to an end. That will significantly boost the free cash flow, because a lot of that expense was capitalized. The second thing is, and we were talking to them about this in the last 2 weeks, is that universities have benchmarked some of the services, their prices they're paid to pay for services. And lo and behold, Tribal has discovered that its pricing is way under the benchmarks. So for example, I'm not fair to say which university, but one university has benchmarked Tribal services at £15 per student, when they're currently paying £3 per student. So I think we're going to see good pricing increasing coming in Tribal. Then we shouldn't forget that there was a bid for Tribal at still a reasonable premium to where we are today. The business, I would argue, is better today than when the bid arrived. And it was frustrated by this American couple, although to call them a couple would be a bit of an exaggeration, as they loathe one another, I'm told. They're in the middle of a horrendous divorce. And my understanding is she never wanted to make the Tribal investment, and he might well want to buy the whole thing one day. So she wins the divorce. She'll probably put the thing up for sale, and if he wins, he might buy it. So, and you know, you had a third party who basically was convinced it was worth 74p.
Yeah.
So the business is better. The biggest issue, which was the lawsuit's gone away. It looks as if they're going to be able to produce new product, and pricing is going to improve. So, what's not to like?
What's the sort of management team there like, given the sort of what's happened? I mean, obviously they're battle hard, and that's for sure.
They certainly are. I mean, we take a great deal of comfort that Roger McDowell is chairman. And he knows exactly what he's doing. We all know that Roger, because he sat on the board with me at Augean, so I know him very well indeed, you know, builds these, and he's obviously on the board of Hargreaves with Nicholas, you know, builds these things to create value for shareholders. Yeah. But, you know, when you've got the headwinds that are now being overcome, it's, you know, you've got to get it going in the right direction before you can do that.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, no, I mean, I like it. I mean, it's definitely trading it. Well, it's about sort of 56p. And even on sort of trough earnings, it's only about 14 and a half times PE. So it's...
I think the carrying revenue just really starts to go from here, as you said.
Yes.
There's a lot of repricing amongst the universities they need to implement.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you take recurring revenue, it's trading at less than 2x.
Yeah.
And for what it's worth, I mean, we think it's trading only about 7x, you know, our estimate of EBITDA two years out. And that's just completely the wrong price for a SaaS-based software business.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. Another one which looks really sort of like mispriced is PayPoint. The shares have done reasonably well, but they still trade at less than 10x PE. This one does the sort of the ATM convenience machines that go into convenience stores. They also do drop off online deliveries into these convenience stores and pick them up, etc. So a bit of, I think it's called Collect Plus, a bit of a competitor to sort of Amazon and DHL and stuff. And also they've got a gift carding business and a Christmas hamper business. Bit of an unbundling play. What's your sort of your view on the PayPoint, Christopher?
Okay, so PayPoint, I think I discussed with you this about 2 years ago. We were very keen on a company called Appreciate.
Yes.
Which got acquired by PayPoint. And so that's how we got to start to know PayPoint management. And we're actually very excited about PayPoint still, even though it's up a lot, as you pointed out. I think the drivers here are the parcel service, which they did, where they believe the number of parcels that will go through their system, the joint venture with the Royal Mail, will increase by well over 100 million parcels. And that's a high margin business for them. They're also very excited about the joint venture with Lloyds Bank, where you will be able to withdraw and deposit money in their stores for Lloyds Bank. And, you know, this fits very much in with these big banks wanting to maintain their high street presence, but not their high street branches. So I think there's going to be two big drivers for the business. The company has also said that it's going to buy back basically about 15% of its shares over the next 3 years, £70 million worth. And it's worth remembering that the Spanish group that owns 30% do not look as if they're going to participate in that share buyback. So their percentage of the company will obviously go up. But it also means that free float, something like 18% of the shares are going to be bought back. So I think it's a management team who are shareholder friendly. They've always paid good dividends. Now they're buying back stock as well. And again, they've just succeeded in, you know, two new ventures. Well, it's not new ventures, they're extending two ventures, which are high growth, because some of their businesses are relatively slow growth. So the emphasis is now going to the high growth businesses. Yeah. And so high growth business will be about 80% of the business and about 20% will be declining. So it's a good story. It generates lots of cash. It's conservatively managed. It's just not a stock that's very well known. And we think over the 3 year period, earnings per share could go up to just under £1. As you said, it's on a PE of about 10 today. So if that would mean we'd be falling to, you know, 6.5x over the period. It's not as exciting as some of the stories we've said, but it's certainly a solid company doing well. And, you know, we've got a good relationship with management there who I think they're worried about their share price. Certainly got down to, you know, £4.50 or something not so long ago. And believe there's significant value in the business, and they're, you know, reasonably big owners themselves of the stock.
And that 30% shareholder, presumably if they're buying 15% of them back, he's going to go through that takeover limit. I'm guessing, is that just mean they're going to have to get a waiver, is it, before they do the buyback?
The takeover panel has said they're an innocent bystander.
Right.
And therefore, they don't have to bid. Okay. So it's... They don't even have to get a vote on it because they're innocent bystander.
Okay, good. Just to remind anybody, if you want to put a question to Christopher or Nick, then just put them into the chat bot and I'll read it out. Last stock, just to quickly run through, Christopher, is Elementis, which is basically a specialty chemicals business that I understand has got a jewel in its crown. It's the it owns the largest hectorite mine out in California. And it's difficult to sort of, I find it, it's quite a difficult one to value. What's the sort of investment case here?
Okay, well, the investment case here is that you've got two businesses there that are really good businesses, and then you've got a telecom business, which isn't such a good business and has been a poison pill for them. They overpaid for it. But what's really going on here is that the largest shareholder, which is Templeton, I can't remember now, owned 10%, and they basically said enough's enough, we want this thing broken up. A number of other shareholders believe this company is worth more in various parts than it is to as a standalone entity. The company is aware of these conversations and has come out with, again, a big self-help program to significantly improve margins. So we believe the private market value of the business is somewhere between 180 and £2, perhaps we need a bit higher. So our view is either someone's going to take this thing or the self-help program will work, but I think it's more likely this thing will get taken over. There's too many activist investors in this thing at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, realized value to the shareholders, basically.
Correct. You know, there was two disastrous acquisitions, really, but the telecom one was the real disaster.
Yeah.
And I think the problem is, at the moment, the telecom business may act as a poison pill. And I just don't think the thing's sustainable as it is at the moment. There's too many people thinking, you know, that these guys have had a long time to prove they can do it and they haven't done it.
Okay, so, good. Well, what's that? Yeah, well, watch that space with interest. Now, last question from Nicholas. He just says he's had many problems with sort of lifestyle companies listed on AIM. How do you avoid sort of like investing in a lifestyle company? I must admit, I've struggled for it. I tend to speak to CEOs sometimes, and I get convinced I don't think they are lifestyle, and then it's only about 6 months later they tell me that things aren't quite as good as they originally intended. But how do you avoid sort of lifestyle businesses?
Well, I think the answer is we probably know it's a lifestyle business when we make the investment. So what we're then looking at is, you know, who are the other shareholders? And would they be generally supportive of change? And, you know, if we think it's a shareholder-friendly register of people who are supportive of change, then we may invest. If we consider they're not, then we won't bother.
And I guess if it in midstream, if you've invested and it turns into a lifestyle business, the manager decides that he's less committed, then I guess because of the active basis, you can change that situation.
Well, we'll certainly try to.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, brilliant. Well, thanks very much, gents, for your time. Fantastic insights there, Nick and Christopher. Last question, just in terms of your overall view on the small cap world and, you know, going forward for the next 6 months. We've seen basically a lot of interest in the top end and the AIM, in AI shares out in the States. NASDAQ's done very well. But there's a lot of mean reversion potential in the smaller sectors of the UK market. UK is about 30-40% discount to the US overall on like-for-like places, but the small caps are even cheaper. I think AIM is about 40% below its high in 2021. So what's your sort of outlook for small caps for the rest of the year, for the next 12 months?
Well, I think there's a number of issues that's sitting there, and the biggest risk to the small cap market is if the Labour government's going to start playing around with the IHT AIM rules.
Yes.
Which would be difficult. Fortunately, most of the stocks we own on are too small to attract the big AIM IHT players. So we think it'll have less impact on us than most. But, you know, we have to be honest that, you know, all ships go up and down with the tide.
Yeah.
So that will be a problem. I think, obviously, hopefully rates will come down. But again, if, you know, it now seems the likelihood that the government's going to improve, you know, 5.5% increase for the public sector, which inevitably is going to put further pricing, you know, wage demands in, you know, in the sort of domestic-based UK companies, which obviously a lot of the small caps are. So that's a sort of further problem. But there's no doubt they're cheap. And there's no doubt in my mind that you're going to continue to see takeovers. It's almost inevitable. So that ultimately creates a problem for us because our gene pool keeps going down because you're just not getting new issues that are particularly attractive. And you know, if we could easily lose another 25, 30 stocks from AIM this year. And the problem is you'll tend to be losing the better ones, if that makes sense.
I'd echo those sentiments. I think at the moment, you know, one of the things we were doing internally was looking at UK equities that had large exposure, a revenue exposure to the US, because if you're a US private equity business and you can buy a UK asset that is all basically already doing all of their sales in the US at a half, you know, half off, it's a no-brainer. So something like Tyman, for example, was a predominantly US-based business trading on the UK index, and it was acquired. So I'd agree. I think there's plenty more opportunity for takeouts, but the IPO market needs to come back online. I know that the likes of Charles Hall at Peel Hunt and the CBI are talking with government, trying to create policies that might generate a bit more volume in UK markets, might encourage a bit more domestic investment. But we all understand the issues with the pension fund money going overseas. How can you, you know, poke them a bit to maybe allocate a bit more to the UK so that we can fund these IPOs and bring attractive assets to the market? So I think, I mean, look, small cap, always interesting. Richard Stavey is our kind of small cap internal historian. And he pointed out that, you know, after if you invest after one down year, your next 3 years is this. If you invest after two down years, your next 3 years, there's a sort of 150% return over the next 3 years. And that goes back one century. So not saying that's going to happen, but historically, you know, we do recover. There is huge amounts of value here. So we're, you know, we're still looking for attractive assets that we can do something with over the next 3 years.
Well, we have a bit of a return to the IPO. We've had Raspberry Pi, and I think a couple of weeks ago we had Rose Bank Industries, which is a bit of a replica of Avingtrans, actually, which both have done okay. So it may lead to a bit more optimism in that new issue.
Yeah, the trouble with Rose Bank was that if you wanted an allocation of that, you had to give them a blank check or at least a check for £200 million, which isn't us.
The fishing pool is north of $1 billion, so yes, the size of deals.
And Raspberry Pi sadly didn't seem to get allocated to the small cap fund managers. So
Things with a bit of luck we'll be looking up. So anyway, thanks again, gents. Very kind to all that generous time and insights. I know investors will greatly appreciate it, and I certainly do. So look forward in touching base again in about 6 months' time.
Absolutely. I'll see you in September.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you to everybody who listened in or dialed in or saw us.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, Sponsored Jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.